Hey everybody, welcome to Carlston Classic Wrestling Audio Show here at figure4online.com, wrestlingobserver.com. I am Carl Stern, host of the show. You've been listening to a marathon week of the Carl Stern shows here at wrestlingobserver.com. And this is the fifth and I suppose final show of this week. Hope you've enjoyed them. I know they've been kind of all over the place. I've recorded them at different times and so forth, but I've been going through and trying to clean out the mailbag and get caught up on some questions and stuff, and we're going to be changing formats, and we've talked about all that. So if you want to go back through the other four shows that have been done earlier in the week, do go back through the archives. And if you download the shows at Figure 4 online by way of iTunes, be sure to go back and make sure you got them all, because sometimes they, you know, if you get several shows during a day and your iTunes feed hasn't updated, you'll miss a show or two. So that's probably could have been the case here on the Carl Stern Show. So definitely go back and check the feed and make sure you got all of them. So on this show, we're going to go. I did a show review of a WWF challenge show from 1985 on the last one, just kind of a spur-of-the-moment type deal. And so for this show, I want to go back into the mailbag and kind of catch up on some stuff that's come in there since we've last recorded a show. So, or last did the Q&A. So, the first email I want to get to is from Matt, and he asks, Carl, do you think it was easier to make wrestlers a top card heel or a top card babyface? I think it was easier to be a top of the card heel because it was, you know, largely, it's easier, I think, to get people to hate you than it is to like you. It's just human nature. I mean, especially in the modern era, it's much easier to be a heel than than to be a top-tier babyface. I mean, there's one trap with a heel you've got to be careful not fall into, and that is to be a cool heel, or, you know, somebody that's looked at as cool or just extremely tough. There has to be something about them that's unlikable, and I think that's easier to pull off than to be liked, because that's a hard one, especially in the modern era, to pull off. Now, back in the older days, you know, you just it was largely method acting. It was just, you know, the good guys were the guys who didn't cheat, and the bad guys were the guys who cheated. And you know, you get a good looking baby face in there, and you know, it was relatively easy, unless he just did something stupid, to be cheered. And the heel, I think it was a lot easier for him too, because, you know, even if he wasn't necessarily on his own accord could get hated by cheating, he could be given some kind of gimmick, like a, you know, an anti-American gimmick or something like that, playing off, you know, the stereotypical foes from back in the day, a Russian or a evil sheik, or, you know, even further back than that, a Nazi or something like that. And so that was relatively simple to do. While being a good guy, you know, the fans could turn on you, especially you know, in the modern era, if you're a good-looking, squeaky clean, you know, baby face that would have worked, you know, in say 1985, that's the kind of stuff that gets you hated today. I mean, you know, John Cena's a perfect example of that. Is there's such a divergent opinions of him from the audience? It's hard to really see that. You know, and The Rock's a perfect example of how hard it is to be a clean-cut baby face. You know, when he debuted as Rocky Maivia, and he was the squeaky clean third generation, you know, pump your fist in the air baby face, and the crowd absolutely turned on him and eat him alive, you know, the Die Rocky Die chants and stuff. And then he showed that you, by going too far the other way and being an arrogant, cool heel, will get you cheered, because by doing that and joining the Nation of Domination and doing the whole cocky, you know, talking about himself in the third person and that whole stick, turned him heel for a little while, but then the fans started cheering him because he was cool. He was anti-authority. He was anti-establishment. And he was just, you know, a badass guy. And that put him over the top then as being a heel, and he reverted to being cheered. So that was really the turning point of things, I think. I think it's easier for a veteran to get respect as a babyface than it is a newcomer. It's you know, a guy like The Undertaker or somebody like that has earned, you know, the respect of just longevity. And I think it's easier for a guy like him, or even Hulk Hogan, whose Hulkamania deal is so over the top and so old school that, you know, it's easy to hate that thing. But because he's been around so long and earned his stripes, so to speak, that, you know, I think he can easily get cheered nowadays, and even by doing that, you know, outdated uber good guy gimmick. So I think overall it's changed. I think back in the territorial days, it was kind of easy to be either one. Now, maybe not a long term, and some were definitely better than others, and some were more subtle than others. And but at the same time, you know, you could pretty much just by use of a gimmick get a guy hated. I think it's always kind of been harder to be a good baby face, or at least to get the bulk of the crowd behind you. This is from Bob, and he says, first off, your podcast is fantastic. Thank you very much. Your History of Wrestling series and older episodes have given me something to listen to while running. So you're at least partially responsible for my dropping 20 pounds over the holidays. Well, thank you very much. I greatly appreciate that. Says, my question concerns Samoa Joe. What do you think his ceiling was? More specifically, do you think with a proper push, he could have become a legitimate star in the industry? My personal belief, which you should feel free to ignore until you've answered the question, if not entirely. Well, let's just explore what you've got to say first, because I do have some opinions on Samoa Joe. He says, my personal belief is that he had the look, charisma, and working ability to ascend to Austin Rock levels if only the company had got behind him around 2007. He seemed able to appeal to the fans of the indie scene who crave work rate, as well as to the average fan who just wants to cheer for someone who looks like a badass and can present themselves as a star. I believe if they would have just kept him unbeaten and give him the title for a couple years, TNA would right now be a legitimate threat to WWE. And I'm not sure there's another person on Earth outside WWE in the last decade you could say that about. Do you think it's too late to give him a mega push? I think it's probably too late to give him a mega push. And again, it says thank you very much, Bob. Well, Bob, thank you very much for checking out the show. And if I'm not mistaken or I haven't overlooked, I think this is the first time you've sent in a question or topic for the show. And it's a good one. It's something that, you know, I think we get I've certainly been too much saddled into one particular era on this show and stuff, and we've exhausted a lot of things. And so to bring it on up, you know, to the 2000 eras, I think it's good, and it's certainly worth looking at. Samoa Joe, if you remember before he came to TNA, he got that long title reign and that big push in Ring of Honor. And I think that's kind of what type push you're alluding to him getting when he first came in TNA. I was excited when he first came into TNA. At that point in time, I'd not got to see any Ring of Honor. I only followed Ring of Honor by way of The Observer, or I may have gotten to see a couple of Ring of Honor DVDs back in those early days, but if I did, it wasn't much. So essentially, I only knew him by name and what had been talked about in the newsletters about him. So when he came to TNA, I liked the way he was presented to begin with. He was presented sort of like Taz was back in ECW as a legitimate badass type wrestler, and he did some unique stuff. And but wrestling was changing, and I remember again, let me again say that initially when he came to TNA, I really did like him. I really thought he was very marketable, and I liked what they were doing with him, and I was aware of what they had done with him in Ring of Honor. And so I was hoping that was the direction they would go with him. But I remember when I met Samoa Joe for the first time, it was at a Wrestle Birmingham show, and I don't remember the year, but he was either just starting out with TNA, or just this was maybe right before he came to work for TNA. I don't recall. He was there with Christopher Daniels working a show there, and I guess he was with TNA at the time because I think Jeff Jarrett was there. This was back during the NWA run of TNA. And I remember being shocked at how small he was. And, I mean, like, I don't know what they ever billed his weight as on television or how big a guy he was. But I always just presumed he was, you know, a larger guy. But when I met him at the show, I was very underwhelmed at how big he actually was. He seemed pretty short. He seemed, of course, he always had that soft look to him. And I was just immediately, you know, kind of taken aback that he really didn't in person live up to what I had in my mind him pictured as, you know, as being and carrying that gimmick. So when I saw him work in person that night, he again did a very good job, very credible guy, but he was working with, you know, I think he might have even worked with Christopher Daniels. I don't remember, who's also a guy who is a smaller stature and so forth. And I remember thinking, well, that's why he's never going to WWE, because even though Taz was kind of able to pull off that badass persona, you know, Paul Heyman really built him up for that whole thing. But, you know, Samoa Joe, again, you know, I think at a certain point, regardless of whether, you know, he got that, you know, Taz type gimmick going for him or not, I think, you know, TNA ultimately just sapped his soul, just his will to work, because he got all out of shape and he got unmotivated. I mean, who can blame him for, you know, TNA was, you know, on the road to nowhere, and still are, and they have no, I mean, you know, there's just, I guess to sum it up, you know, the last part of the question you asked, you know, could he be rebuilt? Could he be, you know, repushed in a way? No, not by TNA, he couldn't. I mean, he's pretty much what he's always going to be. I mean, he's peaked and over and done with as far as TNA is concerned. WWE is never going to do anything with him. He just doesn't fit their mold at all. I mean, they'd make him the, you know, the Funkasaurus, Samoa Joe or some nonsense like that probably. But, you know, he could return to Ring of Honor and possibly be repackaged and get the big push there again. I mean, and use kind of the angst of, you know, what TNA did to him there. But, again, I'm sure his TNA contract pays significantly more than what a Ring of Honor could pay him to return there. So I think pretty much Samoa Joe is where he's, you know, his career's peaked. I don't think he's going up anywhere else. I think he's pretty much going to ride on out basically at the level he is now. I mean, I could see him getting a little push here and there along the way, but he's not going to, I don't think, see any. His glory days, I think, are pretty much far behind him now. Next question up comes from Jack, and he says, what are your thoughts on Dory Funk Sr.? Never saw him, but heard he was a ringmaster in the ring and didn't mess around. If there was any truth to that, and did he break a rookie in to see if he had any heart? He says, awesome shows. Thanks, Carl, for the shows. And any way you can get Terry Funk to do a show with you. I did have Terry Funk do a show with me a long time ago, back for the old Dragon King site. And it was back when his biography was coming out. I've lost touch with Terry Funk years ago. I haven't communicated with him in a long time. And, you know, I got out of the habit of and the desire to do the interviews with the old wrestlers and stuff, because they've just been done to death. I mean, everybody's done a shoot interview, wrote a book or something. If you want to see their story, there's a million and one different places to see it other than me, you know, rehashing the same thing over and over. Dory Funk Sr. way before my time. I'm not familiar at all with his in-ring work, really only his promotional work. And I'm sure he was like all the people from that era. He, you know, I'm sure he did break the rookies in and so forth. I actually learned a good deal about him from Stan Hansen's recent biography. So I would highly recommend that book from Crowbar Press. It was one of the best wrestling books I've read in a long time. And, you know, Stan Hansen broke in the Amarillo territory under Dory Funk Sr. and Terry Funk and Dory Jr. and all that. So it's if you're interested more about him, I would suggest starting there. And if you've never read Terry Funk's biography, it's not bad at all. It's one of my more favorite books. Several years ago, I went to Mexico on a road. Took a motorcycle and rode down there, and along the way, I stopped at a bookstore, and his book had just come out, and I read it on that trip, and it only took me a few days to read it at night when I would stop or whatever, and I remember it being a very good book. I have designs on reading it again. I haven't picked it up since then, and that's been probably six, seven years ago now. So I would need to pick it up to refresh my memory on it, but I remember it being one of the better wrestling biographies. This one's kind of long, but it's got some great information, and it's from Kurt Brown, who always has some great history notes and so forth. So this is about several things we've talked about. He says, as always, totally enjoying the show. I appreciate that, Kurt. Thank you very much. He says, in regards to the questions about the origins of the DDT, I have no idea where or who originated the move, but I remember Black Gordman using it as far back as the mid-1970s. Gordman was best known as Greg Glass's tag partner. In my opinion, one of the greatest heel tag teams ever. You know, I've always heard that about Greg Goliath and Black Gordman. I never got to see them. They were a little bit before my time, and primarily out on the West Coast, so I never got to see them in any other way than by videotape later on, and, you know, some YouTube clips. I never really got to see them in context with what they're doing, but so many people who I respect as historians and so forth have always rave about them as a team. He goes on to say, but he also got fairly healthy pushes as a singles wrestler in Los Angeles' wrestling heyday. His two finishers were the abdominal stretch and the DDT, though I believe they used a different name for the move. I liken the difference between Black Gordman and Jake Roberts' DDT to the difference between an old-school pile driver and Paul Orndorff pile drivers. Both were finishing moves, but the old-school version of these moves drove the head into the mat with a methodical, sickening thud, where the new-school version drove the wrestler's head into the mat with a speedy and charismatic pow. Yeah, there was definitely a difference in those, in those pile drivers. The old-school pile driver, I don't know if it was originated by, but it was certainly popularized by Wild Bill Longson. He would do that. Kind of just, the way you described it is perfect, because that's exactly what it did. They just kind of sat down with it instead of jumping up and driving it down. Tommy Rich really did the Bill Longson type pile driver throughout most of his career, while Paul Orndorff popularized the more dynamic, holding the guy upside down and then jumping up and driving his head down, the more a dynamic pile driver. And, that's one of the things you don't see that much anymore. The tombstone and things like that have replaced it. You don't really see much of the traditional pile driver anymore, especially since it was considered, it was always sold as one of the most devastating moves in wrestling. And Jerry Lawler, of course, also used the newer version of the pile driver. And Jerry Lynn did that package pile driver deal back in the ECW days and so forth. So, you know, it's one of those great moves that's kind of just sort of faded into obscurity over the years, been kind of used to death and, you know, kind of killed for a while. It's just due a comeback. It was one of the more effective moves as far as them getting it over. I think Paul Orndorff had a lot to do with it, but yeah, Wild Bill Longson had long popularized that more dragging style of pile driver. So again, you know, I don't know if there's even any video footage of Bill Longson doing that pile driver. I've seen some pictures and so forth of it, but you can watch older Tommy Rich tapes when he would use it. It's pretty much the same move. He said, I would love to know if any of your other listeners know more about the origins of this move. Black Gordon was a very creative worker in his day, and I have no clue if it was his invention or if it bore previous incarnations, be it in Mexico, where Gordon started out, or elsewhere. I was also intrigued by your comments on the Gary Hart book. I finished the book several months ago and found myself having an odd love-hate relationship with it. I agree totally. Same way. I was intrigued with it. It was an absolute page-turner. I couldn't put it down, and I hated large chunks of it, and really came away with a negative view of Gary Hart. Kind of a love-hate relationship with him. I learned a lot. I admired his I don't even know if you should call it honesty, because I think he embellished a lot of stuff, but his forwardness, I guess, I admired, but I didn't agree with a lot of his opinions and so forth. He seemed like he was a very grudgeful type person, and maybe not the happiest human being I've ever met, but certainly a very tough, mentally tough person, and I admire that sort of thing. But yeah, I definitely agree with the love-hate relationship with it. He said, I love the rich detail memory that Gary Hart retained throughout his career, and I found some of his booking philosophy fascinating. On the flip side, I found it odd how he went into great detail about his pre-wrestling days working with organized criminals, yet discredited guy who wrote a tell-all book, not Jim Wilson's. Believe me, this was a book concentrating on college football in the South. The author's name escapes me, which included racy tales of his friend Jim Barnett. By pointing to the author's criminal past as the sole, quote, red herring to shoot down his argument. Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's a good example that, I mean, don't get me wrong, I don't think Jim Wilson had any real credibility. He seemed like a real odd duck, and, you know, I was on top of that book when it first came out, and I was doing the old Dragon King shows then, and I was trying to think of the other guy's name, who was the co-author, I think, Weldon Johnson or something like that, and maybe it escapes me. But I remember trying to get him or Jim Wilson on that show, and something came out, I don't remember what it was. It was one of the most of the times I always had positive experiences with these people, you know, trying, you know, getting them on the old show and stuff. And it was surprisingly so, you would think, just given the reputation of some of these people. But I found that guy just exasperating to deal with. And I finally just gave up, and he got all offended about it, like, you know, how dare I give up on, you know, like, it was my fault that he was being an ass about, you know, when just, you know, dodging me around and stuff. And I, you know, I just, you know, I'm sorry. I ain't got time to, you know, mess with you. Be on or don't be on, I don't really care. But I remember the book was very informative. Talking about Jim Wilson's book, very informative. But man, you talk about colored by a guy with a grudge. He definitely had some anger issues for sure. Of course, he's passed away now. And that's all, you know, that book's pretty much forgotten now. And it's a shame, because there was a lot of good research in it, but you had to weed through Jim Wilson's very high opinion of himself to get through to it. And Gary Hart certainly was a million times more important power player in the history of wrestling than Jim Wilson ever was. But there was certainly... you know, he had a high opinion of himself too, and a very low opinion of some other people, particularly Jerry Jarrett and Southern wrestling in general. And I took offense to that, you know, he was very, you know, he talked about having an open mind as far as like race relations and homophobia and stuff like that in wrestling. Talked openly about my of that, but at the same time, he had seemingly the same sort of prejudice against people from the South too. So I found that quite hypocritical on his part as well. Plus, I was a huge Memphis fan, and I hated that he just trashed the territory, especially since it seemed like a personal vendetta rather than a true difference in booking philosophies. And then the rant on Dave Meltzer was beyond childish. Yeah, there was a whole chapter in there where he just dogged Dave over some of the most silly stuff. I mean, it was just... Yeah, I found it really odd. I mean, this guy definitely held a grudge over some really seemingly... silly stuff, for sure. Says, as much as I enjoy wrestling autobiographies, and no matter how eloquent they are written, I always find myself reading between the lines, questioning the BS ratio. Yeah, same here. So based on what I've heard from folks who worked with Bobby Jaggers, I really hope he writes his memoirs. It could very well be wrestling's greatest work of fiction. Yeah, I heard a shoot interview quite some time back. It's been probably a year or two ago with Bobby Jaggers, and he does seem like quite a colorful person. But the Gary Hart book, I would recommend reading it for sure. But you know, I've pretty much said everything I want to say about it. Yeah, he's I found him very hypocritical about a lot of things. I thought he overstated his value in certain areas. Now, I don't dismiss anything really he done in Texas because, number one, I don't really know. I just, you know, have to take his word for it. But I think he was pretty straight up on there. But a lot of his other stuff, I think, was quite overplayed. I never liked him as a manager, really, to be quite honest with you. I found him very bland. I found him very uncharismatic. But that has nothing to do with his booking ability and his ability to create characters and so forth. And you know, I totally admire his ability to what he did with the Great Kabuki, because, you know, Great Kabuki to me was one of those characters who made so much out of so little. I mean, Great Kabuki just had this aura about him where he was just this frightening individual and this great gimmick. And then it seemed to me as soon as you put him in the ring, it was just bad. It just, you know, all that went away. But he was able to keep, you know, the Kabuki gimmick going for a while in different areas, and it worked pretty much everywhere it went. Even though the Kabuki wrestler in the ring himself left a lot to be desired, I thought. I also feel like, you know, he downgraded the Missing Link a lot. He called it one of his creations, and then apparently some sort of disagreement between he and Dewey Robertson, who was the Missing Link. He, like, you know, really dogged it out in his book and stuff when he created it and really put it down. And I definitely remember that as being the thing that turned Robertson's career around and took him from a career, you know, mid-carder to a main eventer and a guy who got a shot in the WWF that never would have before. And I thought he was very unfair about that. I've read the Missing Links book before, and it's very good. And I've just pulled it up and started reading it again. In fact, I'm just to the forward part of it. I want to reread that book again, because he was a fascinating person himself who had a lot of demons and a lot of problems. And so I wanted to refresh my memory on that again. And once I get through it, I will definitely take a look at that. And we'll talk about that here on the show. All right, let's see here. We've already answered that one. Okay, here's an interesting email, and this will be our last one for this show. It's a little bit lengthy, but I think it's a good one. This comes from Mike, And Mike says, "Hi, Carl. In the early 1980s, my parents purchased a satellite dish, which was a godsend to an 11-year-old kid on the farm with only two TV channels. God, you're not telling me nothing. I wish we would have had one, because that's essentially the same thing I had going on." Says, "One of the first shows I became addicted to was Georgia Championship Wrestling, which all my friends at school had talked about for months. And the person they always talked about was Tommy Rich. I quickly became a huge Rich fan. I bought all the wrestling magazines with him on the cover, eagerly waited for his segments every week. Looking back now, watching some of his stuff on YouTube from the early 80s, I'm somewhat mystified at his popularity. He was decent, but by no means a great wrestler, an okay promo, had a very average physique, which might be kind. Now some questions. What kind of draw was he? He was always talked about in the magazines as being super popular. Other wrestlers have described him as being like a rock star for the time, yet Dave, in an Observer article, said Georgia at this time was struggling and attendance was going down." Well, that, I don't know that that's so or not. I mean, I'd have to reread what exactly in context Dave was talking about, and maybe as a whole the territory was, but Tommy Rich was blistering popular there in Georgia during that time frame, but it was a very short window of time, and he was very popular. Rock star is a great definition for it, but it was a very short term thing. He was also very popular in Tennessee, in Memphis especially, during short periods of time. But it never really transcended beyond those two places. I had, like you, always seen Tommy Rich was on all the magazine covers. You know, he got a lot of publicity through the After magazines. He got a lot of exposure on WTBS through Georgia Championship Wrestling. I was also aware of him from the Memphis shows as well, so I knew Tommy Rich was this big Southern star, but he had never came through Southeastern Wrestling or Continental. Well, then he did come to Continental, and I thought, you know, it's going to be a big deal. You know, Tommy Rich is like has far more of a resume than any of the people who were presently working there. And then he come in and was really unremarkable there. He never really caught fire in the Alabama area. He had a tag team run with Johnny Rich and with Steve Armstrong. He had a few singles runs here and there, but he was by no means ever the top babyface star, and wasn't by any means, stretch of the imagination, the biggest star in this area. So I found it kind of odd that, you know, in all the surrounding areas he was this big deal, and then here he wasn't at all really a big deal, a mid-card to upper mid-card guy at best, and he didn't have a lot of longevity in the Continental area. I think in Tennessee, which was, you know, where he proclaimed his home state and all that, he started out there, and I think he had more depth of character there, because he would switch from a heel to babyface, and he was never as hot as a babyface in Tennessee as he was in Georgia. Just something about him in Georgia just clicked and really took off there, and I think it was just a difference of the population there, the fans, what they were looking for at that particular time. Against the people that were there as well. He was always going to play second fiddle as a babyface in Memphis to Jerry Lawler and even Austin Idol and people like that. Whereas in Georgia, you know, you had a lot more grizzled heels and stuff for him to play off of, guys like Harley Race and the Masked Superstar and people like that, Stan Hansen and whatever, for him to work against. And then, you know, the super popular guy down there was Mr. Wrestling too, who was behind a mask, so he filled that pretty boy babyface role real well. And it was, and then he had that red hot feud with Buzz Sawyer, who was just, you know, this rugged bad guy, and I think that just all that chemistry together worked real well for him. Whereas in Tennessee, I think he really worked better as a heel there, because he couldn't be the top guy over Jerry Lawler, especially in his younger days. And by the time he was older and put on weight and so forth, he was not going to be the pretty boy baby face there anymore, and so it was more natural for him to be the heel. He had that short stint in the AWA where it was really unremarkable there. Of course, AWA was about Billy up by that time anyway. He had a short stint in Crockett, where he was, early days of WCW, where they tried to repackage him as Thomas Rich, and he was briefly okay right there, but then that burned out pretty quick as well. And then, of course, he did the deal with ECW, where he was somewhat of a comedy. Well, he was a comedy figure there, but he was well known through the magazines and so forth. So he had this great degree of popularity. But I think it was just right place, right time kind of thing. Part two of the question: why exactly was he so popular? I just think I said all I need to say about that. It says Jim McAdams said on his old tape site that WWF 1982 wanted to bring him in as a heel challenger to Backlund. Have you heard this? And how do you think he would have done? I've never heard it, but I guess it would have been popular. Although 1982, he was really skinny and had that stringy blonde hair, and that might have played well down in Georgia, but I just don't know how. I mean, he would have looked like a prelim guy, I think, up there in WWF. And against Backlund, I just don't see a dynamic there. I mean, I know, I don't know. I just can't see how that would have worked. But maybe he did. I'm sure it could have been talked about. I mean, he was red hot, and I wouldn't have blamed them at all for trying to get him in for a little while. But as a heel against Backlund, I don't know. It's an unusual dynamic there for sure. And number four, what led to his quick decline? Alcohol, drugs, or did he simply run up against the steroid era and a lack of physique doomed him? Well, I think it was a combination of those things. I mean, his personal demons are very well documented. He is, he's had Tommy Rich has battled just about every demon you can think of that there is to battle. And I think also he just kind of ran out of steam. I mean, he got lost, and I think once his red-hot run in Georgia was over with, he never could really recapture that in Tennessee for the reasons we mentioned. And then Georgia Championship Wrestling, of course, ended up, being bought out, the time slot bought out there by Vince McMahon, and that whole thing falling apart, and they tried to restart it and didn't work. And so he kind of lost his area that he was the most popular guy in. And so he, by the time Turner came along and bought Jim Crockett out in the WCW, well, it was more of a national expansion type thing, and Tommy Rich never did catch on outside the Deep South. I mean, Georgia and Tennessee, he was just a very popular guy in two states. He had, and his promos were great for the crowd he played to. You couldn't necessarily take a Tommy Rich promo and play it in front of, a Midwestern audience or a Texas audience or a New York audience and them think it was anything other than awful. But for Tennessee and Georgia, I mean, he had that. I liken him a lot to Kerry Von Erich in Texas, in that Kerry Von Erich just had this dumb Texas high school jock charisma to him that everybody loved to death down there. That wasn't necessarily going to play well at all anywhere else, but the people there just ate that up. Well, Tommy Rich had that good old boy down the road, redneck, your neighbor's kid that just played to this particular audience. But you couldn't necessarily take that and put it in front of another audience and expect it to work. Whereas somebody like Ric Flair, I mean, is the pretty boy, playboy, got more money than you, more women, rub it in your face, that's going to play pretty much anywhere, especially to, a lower socioeconomic area like the Deep South. It's also going to play well in front of a more wealthy economic area like, New York, where you play on the greed and the jealousy of it. So that type persona is going to play everywhere, whereas what Tommy Rich was doing, unless you were around here, around people like that, you weren't necessarily going to appreciate it as well. So hope that answers your questions. That's some good questions, some stuff we've not talked about here on the show before. So this will be part five of the marathon week. Going to wrap it up. And, You know, maybe there'll be a part six. I don't know. The next show, we'll do a show next week regardless. I've still got several more emails to go through, looks like. So maybe we will hit another show. Just all depends on how my schedule goes. I want to again encourage you to drop by over to carlstern.com. It's Carl with the letter K. K-A-R-L-S-T-E-R-N, carlstern.com. And check out the Stern Sticks, which I sell. They're two flash drives. You can buy them separately or buy one of each. And you read up all about them over there. It's got lots and lots of audio on it. Lots and lots of history. Old newsletters from back in the early days of the territory, you know, the 60s, 70s, even up into the 80s. There's a lot of career records, tens of thousands of results on Stern Stick 1, lots and lots and lots of audio on both of them, and it's none of it's repetitive. It's all different content, so you can buy both of them, not get replicated content. So go over there and check it out, carlstern.com, if you're interested in shows like this and history shows and interviews. It's got some of the old Dragon King shows where I talk to people like Robert Fuller and Pat Rose and Jeff Jarrett and God, I can't even remember who all, Jimmy Valiant and a number of different classic wrestling stars I've interviewed over the years. That's all up over there. So thanks a lot for listening, and do check that out. Appreciate it.